Hello, I'm David Mack. Sometimes, and it's a rarity, I'm a thinker, but I'm not satisfied with my answers because of my limitations. So I'm very, very happy to have a good colleague and friend. Peter is very, very, very interesting in that he has a practice of self-realization and meditation since his early years. He lives a fast-paced Western lifestyle with interests ranging from quantum physics to business strategy, jazz, modern art. I put him in the same category with Socrates, Plato, some of the great minds. I want to take advantage of this opportunity and pose a few questions to Peter, some of the things that's been plaguing me, and hopefully you can glean from this also. Peter, how are you doing?
Hello, David. I'm doing great. It's so lovely to be here.
Most men die with heart attacks statistically on Monday. But do you think probably that could be because they don't like their job? They don't, here we go another week, that kind of thing. Preferring to be with the family over the weekend and having to leave all of that and go back to the stress-related jobs and the unwanted jobs, but having to work because of putting bread on the table, all of those things.
I think it can be a combination of things. Obviously, after weekend, it might be sort of a different situation you're facing. You have to once again start to work, and if you don't specifically like your work, then you're building up the stress factors.
So stress mostly comes from negativity. We might dislike something or something that bothers us and that kind of thing.
It's a physical thing also. So you can see the adrenaline and different factors in the your muscles are tense and there's a lot of physical involvement in the process so it's all together. You're in a sort of a situation mentally and physically where you are not in relaxed and in a good mood in a way. So I think it can also build up over a long period of time. So if your environment is very stressful, and if you're constantly in stress, that obviously can have a lot of consequences in the longer term. And then suddenly one Monday morning, you're dead.
I think if a person has some kind of focus, meaningful focus on life, maybe the enjoyment of the wife, the children, looking forward to a vacation, a little time away from the grinding wheel of work, assuming that you like that work, that kind of thing.
Hmm.
You think that could play into reversing the statistics, or if there's something meaningful going on and there's happiness? I don't know.
Well, happiness and fear, I think they're the opposites. Or happiness and love, fear and love, I mean. So basically anything coming out of fear, you're not free to act. You're acting out of some compulsion, something, you're having a fear of something, you're afraid of something, and that's making you to act certain way or behave certain way. So it's sort of forced way of living.
Okay, it says the happiness in its purest form is just another expression for sympathy and empathy in their deepest meaning. Happiness is a fundamental form. In its fundamental form, it's not reflected to the subject itself. It is shared and experienced together with existence and with other beings. Okay, so one would have to share it. Could one just be happy with oneself?
Yeah, you have to start with yourself. If you are not happy within and with yourself, you're not comfortable with yourself, how can you be happy, with other people? That's just pretending. And when you're pretending, you're not, true. And obviously people can see it, or at least you cannot keep up, keep it constantly, sort of be in the happy mood if you truly are not happy. So the happiness starts from yourself. And when you're happy and you truly are happy, other people see it and you're relaxed and, in good mood and, things go nicely. And then you sort of radiate the happiness to other people and they pick it up. And what you actually described was more like unconditional happiness or unconditional love. So Meaning that it's not related to the environment, you are not dependent on the external circumstances. You always are sort of in the state of happiness or joy, no matter what are the circumstances, because they change. Sometimes you are in a very good and fortunate position, and another time things are sort of against you. But still you have always a choice of deciding how do you take the situations. Because in many cases there's only a certain amount of things you can change or be in control, and the other factors are just something you just have to take as they come. So you cannot change them, you're not in control. And the acceptance of those factors you are not in control is part of the happiness. If you realize that, you know, there are things you cannot change, it's raining, you know, it's just raining, you cannot do anything about it, it's just the weather, you accept it, so you can as well enjoy the rain and not just complain about it or be sort of in the bad mood about it.
Well, you know, would you say then that if happiness were dominant in us, spirit or whatever, wherever it is in us, then fear would be more subdued, and there would be less possibilities if one were happy to have a heart attack on Monday, if one were a male?
Well, I certainly think so. If you're smiling and you're more in a relaxed atmosphere, you know, you just your body is not tense, and you end up doing something because you have to do, but you want to do something, and you know, you're free willingly expecting and full of joy and expectations for the forthcoming day. Most likely, you might not die on Monday morning, or in those circumstances, but you know, obviously there's 7 days in the week, so if you die, you will die one of those days, so it why not Monday? But you know, it could be some other day as well.
Yes, but I guess the number was quite noticeable because it's an overwhelming number for Monday. I don't know really if even like tears of happiness, of, you know, one feeling sorry for oneself or having the sorrow that this was in one. There's an article that brought out that when you cry sorrowful tears, there's an overwhelming amount of protein in the teardrops.
Okay.
And if they're happy tears, there's no protein in it. And they found that the protein that one is releasing in the sorrowful tears, it's noxious, it's poisonous to the body. So when one cries, there's therapy in that sorrowful tears, because you're getting rid of, if nothing else, even the toxic protein. And a pot of snake venom is also foreign protein. So when one gets rid of foreign protein in the body, that's therapy. It's good. So crying in that sense, if these are sorrowful tears, that can be therapeutic. What do you think of that?
Well, it sounds very interesting and also very efficient from the nature's point of view. You're releasing in many levels at the same time. So it makes a lot of sense. And I think it's good that you actually express your emotions and do not depress them within. It's better just to feel how you feel and sort of let it all come out. And then you can go move on. But if you just keep them within you yourself and do not express how you feel, I don't think it's a good way of living, and keeping things within yourself for a long period of time actually builds the stress as well. So either you want to do it in a small releases whenever you feel like it, or you need to do it, or then you just have it at once, and maybe that at once is then a Monday morning and a heart attack. And maybe that also was a lead or hint for us as well, that you know, if the body is releasing something while crying, that same happens, and if we do not cry and we still feel like it, you know, these toxins are still within in our system, and we cannot get them out. So absolutely, if you feel
which ultimately has a detrimental negative effect.
Yeah, but is it worse to have it inside or just let it come out?
Well, if you keep it within, like some people think that it's not good to cry if you're a male. It's a sissy thing. It's not good.
Yeah.
but women will cry. And I think statistically, could that be equated with their living longer because they dump, they get rid of it? And we tend to think we're macho and we're not supposed to express ourselves and we're not supposed to cry. And all of a sudden, it takes its toll.
Yeah, it could be that, you know, male are also expressing themselves. If you're not supposed to, you're not allowed to cry, you might turn angry, or you become aggressive, or you do something else. So it takes just another form. And that might be even more dangerous or not so good for your health. And that's, I think, typically what happens if you just don't cope with your emotions. You know, they just find another way to come out or find a sort of a ventile, and it might be your health. That you start to have health issues if you're constantly in stress and you're feeling anxiety and altogether don't feel good. And I think you're the nutrition and food expert, but I would suppose that when you're not in a good mood, you might, or you're tired, and you tend to also eat not so well. You start to take those things what you're supposed not to eat, which are actually more poisonous and not so good for your body either. So when you're tired, you start to go to white sugars, and you try to boost up things. And when you also have, maybe you've been working overnight, then you just tend to drink a lot of coffee and go for the food with a lot of fat and things like that. So I think it goes, might be also something which goes together.
If we can find a way to, apparently from what I'm gathering from your good information, is if we find a way to relieve our innermost thoughts that are negative and get rid of it, as the saying goes, vomit it out. And that in itself will be good therapy. And if there's a need to cry, even if we're embarrassed to let people see us cry, it's good to go somewhere in the privacy of our home or whatever and just dump, cry. I don't know. I think that those things would, and also look at the things that we can't change and try to somehow cope with them without being negative while we're coping with them, because it's like one has a wife that nags, and those things that he doesn't like about his wife, they can nag and nag and nag and build up inside of him. And then, or he has a boss who doesn't like, a workmate. But you can't change these people because they're not ready to change. And so what do you do? You know?
No.
I don't know. What would you do?
Well, I think you always have a few choices to make. Either if you don't like the job, you can change the job and go somewhere else, or just, you know, if you don't, in a relationship, you don't think there's anything else, you know, you can do about it, and you just cannot take it, you know, then you can just go your separate ways. Or that's obviously a very radical alternative, but that's always an alternative. Another way to see the thing is that you stop playing the victimhood role and just accept it, that, you know, that's the person how it is. And, you know, and if you realize that it's not personal, that, you know, it's just consistent with each and every other person as well, so it's not something, you know, against you, it's just something, you know, what that person does, so you can just take it more lightly and just forget it. Or you can maybe try to talk with that person and you know, just discuss those issues if you like. But you always have a choice then. And why would you react something that is not, you know, which is entirely nonsense? You know, if someone just, you know, claiming something which is just absolutely nonsense, you don't, you know, you don't react, or you just, you know, disregard it as, you know, something, just something totally out of this world. So I think you it's always up to us. And it's very easy to go to the victimhood role and being the victim, and that, you know, I cannot do anything, and, you know, everybody is just bullying me, and, you know, it's all coming, you know, it's all my fault, and so on and so forth. Or then we can just, you know, take it like that, okay, that person is having a bad day, or, you know, that's just how he is, and, you know, she is, and I cannot do anything about it, but I can focus on some good things, or some other positive things, and not just, you know, pick and choose those negative things, which obviously each and every person has, you know, something negative as well, or something we don't like. So it's always us to, you know, see the world how we want to see it.
So, would you say then that as far as a relationship or whatever, would you say to some degree anything is repairable or there are things that are irreparable? We're not talking about the physical things, like a person that's lost its leg.
No.
Obviously, that leg is atrophied and it's gone. But let's just say situations with your mate or with your environment or whatever. You think everything is repairable or there are limits?
I think you have to set your own limits. No one else can say, you know, what is irreparable and what is still to be sort of fixed. I think you make the choice, and it's obviously not an easy choice to make, but you know, if you take something and you don't truly believe that, you know, there's any hope for anything, you know, then you're suppressing once again. Then you may be acting out of fear. Another type of fear. Your fear of sort of coping the reality and moving on. And that once again comes back to the happiness. If you're happy all the time, no matter the circumstances, and if you're acting how you feel, truly feel, then if you've been trying to fix the situation for a long, you know, many times, and you know, maybe a period of time, and it doesn't work, and there's no change, and you think you have done your best, and nothing else you can do about it, maybe then you have to make a choice and move on. So I think it's no one else can tell anyone that, you know, you should do this or that. Obviously, if they ask you advice, you can give them, but you know, it's a personal call, judgment call to make.
Yeah, that word is frightening. That term is frightening to me, judgment call. I mean, because of our imperfections and our limitations, we make judgment, or we, you know, that to me, that's one of the fears and phobias, literally a phobia that I had when my children were growing up. They'd come to me for advice, and I felt so inadequate. The only thing I could rely on is some experience. In other words, I've touched that stove, and it burned, so I could tell them that because I've experienced it. When they get into an area that they come to me for an answer, it's very difficult for me as a father because I wanted to make sure that they were guided properly, yet I was limited with what I could do to help them.
Well, I think the only thing you can ever give to another person is just your own experience and your point of view. So you can sort of prepare them and give them maybe some description or your ideas about the topic, and in that way sort of prepare the ground. But I think it's a very difficult situation, especially with children, because they're looking at you as a parent, sort of as an authoritative figure, and you know, telling and seeing what is true and what is wrong, and obviously there's no those things like, you know, that's absolute truth and absolute not true. So yeah, I think it's really, that's also something that, you know, how depending on the person and the relationship, but you know, if I think children can also feel if you sort of honest and you're telling your opinion and even exposing yourself by telling that, hey, I don't truly know, you know, this is not my field of expertise, but this is how I think, and you can see it from this perspective and that perspective, and I think in this particular case you might consider this option. Obviously, depends a lot, you know, how old the children are, but you know, I think it's once again that, you know, if you act and think and speak like you feel and truly see it from your perspective, that's the best thing you can do. And obviously, the best way to sort of be a role model is to be a role model. So not talking about things, but actually doing those things. So in practice, they see that, you know, you're talking and walking, and you're walking the talk, and not just talking and walking the other direction.
Well, you know, even like beauty, as to beauty being in the eyes of the beholder, what's beautiful to me might be ugly to you, and what's beautiful to you might be ugly to me.
No.
I think a baby hippopotamus is ugly, but to that hippopotamus's mother, it's a cute baby, you know.
Exactly.
So beauty, in that sense, is in the eyes of the beholder.
Well, it is always like that, you know, it's just that it's you basically reflect your perception and your experiences and all your sort of history and your background, and that's how do you perceive the beauty then. That's beautiful, you. In your one particular moment in time, it might be that tomorrow it doesn't look so beautiful anymore. Maybe it's a bit stinky, you know, and or something else has happened, so you're not seeing it the same way.
Well, then it's the next day, it's not beautiful anymore because it's changed. So in that sense, it's not the same. It's like a picture. Now, I don't think the Mona Lisa is a beautiful woman. I think the painting is an excellent work of art.
No.
But I don't think she's a beautiful woman. I've seen Sophia Loren, being Italian, I think Sophia Loren is more beautiful than Mona Lisa. So beauty is relative, I guess.
Yeah, it's, and like you said, something has changed, but is it actually who has changed, or is it the setting, or maybe both of them? Like you said, that, you know.
Well, the things that you think is beautiful today, tomorrow, because of the sun, erosion, elements, or whatever, it changes. Let's take a car. You buy a brand new car, you wash the car almost every weekend. You see the guys out there spit shining the car and washing it. All of a sudden, after a while, the car gets nicks on it, it gets this, that, and other, and it's not as beautiful anymore because of wear and tear. So it's not the same car that it was when you first bought it.
No.
And we tend to behave accordingly. You marry a beautiful woman, she gains weight, she starts not taking care of herself like she was when you first met her. So it's not the same person. But that's where unconditional love, I think, comes in, where we have to kind of understand that that's what's going to happen, and we love a person in another way other than the physical beauty. I don't know.
Yeah,
am I crazy for thinking that way?
Yeah, the thing is that when you typically fall in love, and what you see is that those are your expectations. You're expecting something. It's not unconditional. So you're having sort of an image of something in your mind. And for a short period of time, that image somehow is aligned with how do you perceive the reality. But then obviously things happen and people change, or we never know truly any other person. It's just our perception of the persons and situations. And the funny thing with, for example, the example you described is that it has nothing to do with another person. Because, you know, the beauty is in the eye of the beholder. You defined the beauty in the first place, not her. So you said, you know, it's all happening within your mind. It's all in your mind. And that's what is happening. It's a mind game. So we sort of see the outside world in a manner that it sort of it has some use for us. It's sort of we have some kind of relationship with the world which is not equal. It's more like that we demanding or asking for something, and that's typically goes on all the different relationships and situations, and that's sort of the catch-22 and the paradox, that it's all in your mind. So one day you decide that, you know, it's great, and another day you decide it's not great anymore, and you haven't asked from another person a thing. So unconditional love and is something that you are not expecting anything back. Regardless of the situations, regardless of anything external, you do it anyway. So if you truly like the person, you are not sort of wanting something. Because if you're in a situation or position of needing something or wanting, it's not sort of an equal position. You are in a position that where you're taking something. And if then on the other hand, if we let's imagine a situation or relationship where both parties are not expecting or wanting anything, they're just having good time, like good friends, you know, that, you know, we don't need anything, you don't need anything, you know, from another person, you just enjoy the company and just, you know, being together, and that's sort of more free and you know, different way of sort of also defining relationships, and typically the first case, and if you just listen to the love songs, they typically talk about me, myself, and I, my ego, my love. You know, it's about possessions. It's about how do you feel. It's about your satisfaction. It's about things in you, and another person is just the means for your end, for your satisfaction. And when you sort of achieve what you want, if maybe it's security you want to have a financial security, so you marry someone. And when you get the money, then you, once again, you not satisfied anymore because you're already having the money, but then your mind is going to other things. Maybe you want something more. Or some, it can be, it doesn't have to be beauty, it can be possessions, it can be low self-esteem, you want to be with you know, some other people around, or you want to show off. So it can be various of different motives, but all of these are actually coming out of fear. Once again, you're acting out of fear. There's something underneath. And you're projecting that to the other person or to the situation. And you're trying to sort of get that what you don't have by associating yourself or attaching yourself, clinging to that external person or situation or thing.
So thanks again, Peter. You've been very, very helpful. And we look forward to the next time.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure. And I'm looking forward to our next show.